This is PCJ Radio International.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Well, hello, friends and listeners, and welcome again to another edition of the program. It's very nice to have you with us. I first want to begin today's show by talking about some mail that we've received over the past couple of weeks. Now, those who do follow international broadcasting have probably heard the rumors that the Voice of Russia World Service is planning to leave shortwave by the end of the year. Now, these have come from Russian websites and also Russian newspapers, but still nothing from the Voice of Russia themselves. Now, just a couple of days ago, the Russian government decided to do away with the agency that was formerly looking after everything and to put everything under one umbrella, which is called Russia Today, sort of the same name as their TV network. Now, it would be slightly irresponsible for us to do anything right now, because I did contact Voice of Russia, and the reply that I got from them, well, it wasn't a denial, and it wasn't a confirmation. I have a suspicion that even the staff at Voice of Russia still don't know what is going to happen with that. Now, if the story does change before the end of the year, we will definitely cover it. So that's the only thing I'm going to say now on the matter, because there just isn't enough information. It is the month of December, and we have a couple of special programs for Media Network Plus coming up. The last show for the year, we'll be looking at radio bloopers. We've had a number of them sent in from listeners all around the world, and that's going to be at the end of the month, so it's a show that I think you will certainly enjoy. But leading up to that point, we've had some emails and also correspondence that have come in from people wanting to hear certain interviews again. One of those interviews was a story that we did earlier this year on pirate radio. There's a fascinating book called The Death of the Pirate by Adrian Johns, and it's a fantastic look at pirate radio. So let's step back a bit and listen to the whole thing again.
Wonderful Radio London.
Going back in time on the sounds of the nation, it's the Caroline Flashback.
And the pirates were in no way carbon copying some of the format radio that was going on in the United States. So there's you know, layers of copying that go on here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true. You know, the 60s pirate stations did foment a real transformation, mainly in the UK, actually slightly earlier on in some continental countries as well in Europe, because the BBC had been to some extent a model for European public broadcasting systems. So there were other countries like Denmark and the Netherlands where there were similar pressures, and pirate radio there too had a transforming effect. It's quite a big deal if you think of the history of how broadcasting has been regulated. That has major implications for public culture, the quality of public discussion, and so forth. And the pirate stations in the 60s were really a turning point in that.
Well, this actually now leads me to the next question. I mean, the pirate radio stations in the UK at the time, they were really seen as pirates. They were seen as they weren't looked upon well by the British establishment at the time, especially the postmaster's office that was aggressively trying to shut them down. And your book, Death of a Pirate, is actually a true account of a crime story that was involving one of these stations. When did you first hear about it?
Okay, this is a story, the outlines of which have actually been known for a long time. But when I came across it, I was in the National Archives in London, actually, which is a huge building in Kew, just to the west of the main part of London, that holds all kinds of state documents going back centuries. And I happened to come across a reference to this legal case that followed on from the shooting. And so just out of curiosity, I called it up. And it turned out to be 1,000 pages long. And it was the entire police investigation and court record of the incident, which turned out to be fascinating. It was almost a kind of anthropological account of the entire culture of pirate radio in the mid-1960s. And it really, I don't think it had been seen by anybody since the trial, which was 66, 67.
When you came across the documents, did they show, for example, did they show how the government at the time really viewed the pirates? Because, you know, if you look back at some old interviews, quite often there were members of government, MPs, that would say, you know, these people were criminals and they were the lowest form of person in society.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, there are the state documents do tell you something about, for example, cabinet level discussions about what to do about the pirates in the early to mid 60s. I have to say that the popular image that exists, that the government and the BBC and the Postmaster General were all just, you know, stuffy reactionaries, I don't think that's quite right. I think that they were struggling to deal with questions about media regulation that were actually quite deep and you know, were going to have long-run effects that were hard to predict. And they, it's true that some of them were just in principle opposed to the idea of, say, commercialization or to pop music itself, which they did see as culturally degrading. But there are others who thought that there should be some compromise possible. At one point, the minister in charge of policy was actually Tony Benn, who has an interesting history himself. You may know he's the doyen of a certain kind of left-wing Labour politician. And for him, I think it was rather a torturous position to be in, because he is a believer in, you know, popular freedom, essentially. But at the same time, he's also a believer in improving the public culture and against commercialization. So I think one of the reasons why the government tended to speak loudly but not do very much was that it was actually rather agonized in the way that Ben himself was about exactly how strict to be and what policies to adopt.
Step up to a new level of musical velvet. Smooth sounds of the smart set. Hallmark of quality, Britain Radio.
Music now. Radio Veronica is your station.
Do you think that also part of the opposition that the government at the time had toward the pirates, especially the BBC, was over some of the rules and regulations that were part of the musicians' union? For example, as you probably are aware, for many years, most of the music that was on the BBC had to be either recorded at the BBC or had to be played live, and they were limited to the amount of records that of studio recordings that they can play a week. But yet the pirate radio stations, that's all they were playing.
Yeah, that's true. The BBC was under an agreement called Needle Time that dated back to roughly the end of World War II. And it's a kind of collaboration between the musicians' unions and the copyright agencies. In that, what it did was it as you say, it limited the BBC's ability to play records and pop records in particular, partly in a bid to try to preserve as many musicians' jobs as possible. So BBC were basically doing their own cover versions of things, and this is a kind of interesting point, because there were people within the BBC who would dearly have liked to play more pop music. They thought the BBC was missing out and that it ought to have a more leading role. But they couldn't, because they were running up against Needle Time. And so Needle Time limited the BBC to something like 20 hours a week of playing records. And most of those hours were given over to classical music, because the BBC saw its mission more broadly as cultural improvement, and classical music served that end. And that was really why the BBC was not able to compete in the stakes of popularity with the pirates. The pirates, as you say, were just playing pop music records end to end all day. by about 1965, there were 10 or so pirate stations operating various places around the coast of the UK. And one of them operated out of an old World War II anti-aircraft fort that sits up on stilts out in the North Sea, just off the Thames estuary. And it was called Radio City. And a rival pirate entrepreneur called Oliver Smedley essentially tried to take over Radio City by force, essentially. He hired a bunch of stevedores from the dockyard in London, and they went out in the middle of the night and hijacked the station. This led to a couple of days of angry confrontations with the station's boss, a kind of an enterprising figure called Reg Calvert, which culminated with Calvert turning up at Smedley's house in the countryside at the middle of the night, and there was a brief confrontation, and Smedley shot him. Smedley shot Calvert dead. That shooting was actually the catalyst for the government shutdown of the entire pirate system and a transformation in BBC broadcasting to compensate for that shutdown. There are all kinds of episodes, stories behind why the shooting took place and what the consequences of the shooting were for Smedley's and Calvert's families and party.
You know, it's interesting, actually, when I was reading a little bit about it, because Calvert actually was also, at the time, the manager of a British singer by the name of Screaming Lord Sutch. And one of the stations, actually, that they'd set up was called Radio Sutch. When all this was going on, after he was killed, how much time was there before Radio One was set up?
It's about a year, and that's really for the period for the court case to run through and for legislation to run through the British Parliament. There was a certain debate about exactly how to respond to this, but there wasn't much debate that there had to be a serious response. I think there was a general consensus that pirate radio is one thing, but actually having people shot is a much more serious issue. And the thought was that if pirate radio was going to lead to that kind of activity, then suddenly the government has a kind of mandate, if you will, for shutting it down. So it took about a year for Radio One to be set up. And when it was set up, of course, it recruited a certain number of the DJs straight out of the pirate ships. And along with their format, the idea of jingles, for example, were taken over from the pirate ships. And this was widely recognised, that it was essentially a kind of imitation of that already proven formula.
Now, with the clock ticking slowly up to 7 a.m, it's going to be time to welcome Radio 1's first daily show on 247 metres medium wave, whilst breakfast special continues on Radio 2. 10 seconds to go before Radio 1, Tony Blackburn, and Radio 2, Paul Hollingdale, stand by for switching. Get tuned to Radio 1 or 2, 5, 4, 3. Radio 2, Radio 1, go.
The voice of Radio 1. Just for fun.
Music.
Too much.
And good morning, everyone. Welcome to the exciting new sound of Radio 1.
When you were researching the book, did you have the opportunity to speak to people that knew Smedley and Calvert?
I spoke to their families. Both families were very helpful to me. I've spoken to a few people who are veterans of the pirate stations of that time. Not so much Radio City, which was Calvert's station, but there are. As you may know, there's a very lively kind of amateur historian culture about pirate radio in the 60s, which is largely fueled by people who are veterans from that world. So it's possible to find out an immense amount, actually, about what it was like to live on the ships, how the choices of music were made, and things like that. So yes, but there's much more that could be done. I mean, one could find out a lot more about the day-to-day operations, for example, of Project Atlanta, which was Smedley's original radio station.
With these radio stations, does the information, for example, on the day-to-day operations of these stations, does that information still exist in say, printed form, log sheets or memos?
To some extent it does. it would be a question of digging through people's attics, really, for it. So I came across a trove of material to do with Radio Atlanta, the Smedley's original station, out in a farmhouse in the far west of England, where the widow of one of the DJs, and in fact Smedley's cousin, still had these things in boxes. So they had things like the advertising rate sheets, the reports that Smedley was making to investors on an annual basis, all that kind of material, which was never really published. It wasn't secret either. It was just, you know, internal corporate documents. And I suspect there's probably quite a bit of that still around somewhere. It would be a question of finding the individual private citizens who would hold on to it.
Were there any surprises that you came across when writing this book?
The book actually goes right back to the origins of broadcasting in the 1920s in order to account for what happened in the mid-60s. And there's a fair amount of surprising stuff to do with the history of public broadcasting through that interim period in the 20s through the 60s. For example, the strangest thing is a controversy in the late 1930s that came fairly close, actually, to bringing down the BBC at that point, which has to do with an invisible poltergeist mongoose that lived in a farmhouse on the Isle of Man. The editor of The Listener, which was a highbrow magazine sponsored by the BBC, got involved in a project to try to investigate this paranormal phenomenon. And as a result of which, he was the BBC hierarchy essentially kind of lent on him to try to keep quiet when it was pointed out that this may be just crazy. And that led to questions in Parliament about whether the BBC was a kind of incipiently Mussolini fascist organization, because it was tyrannical over its own employees. And this came about at one of the periods when the BBC's charter had to be renewed. So there are parliamentary debates coming from this issue about a ghost mongoose that where MPs were really quite angry and were urging that the BBC essentially should be shut down. It survived that, but still, that was a very strange episode.
Well, with the pirate radio stations, because you mentioned that it goes back to the beginning of the book, of course, goes back to the 1920s and 1930s. The clandestine radio stations that were on the air from the UK during the Second World War, would they or could they be categorized as pirates?
In a certain sense, they could. In the lead up to the Second World War and then through World War II, the British organized clandestine broadcasting into the Reich and into the northern continental Europe. They could be characterized as pirates because by that point there was already an international system of wavelength regulation, according to which it was regarded as unacceptable to broadcast into a neighboring country without that country's approval. So yes, you could have thought of them as pirates, but obviously the role of them was not that of the role of pirates in peacetime. I mean, these were propaganda and to some extent espionage operations. Wherever you go.
Just take a lively companion wherever you go. Take a portable radio. Take a portable radio.
Caroline.
Golly gee, look at
that. You know, it's amazing when you think back now, because these pirates, really, they were going against the giant, the BBC, and they attracted so many millions of listeners, not just in the UK, but anywhere where the signal could be picked up. There were some cases, of course, that some of the pirates, their signals were even picked up in Northern Africa.
Yeah, that's true. I did come across complaints about interference from pirates that came in from quite long distances to the British government, so Far Eastern Europe, Yugoslavia, places like that. And it's true, they got very large audiences. I believe that even, for example, Harold Wilson, who was Prime Minister at the time, was listening to Radio Caroline, I think. So, and this was one of the problems that, of course, the government faced, was that the pirates were simply so popular. And this was a time when the two major political parties in the UK never got more than a wafer-thin parliamentary majority, one over the other. So taking action against a very popular form of media could well have doomed the government to opposition the next time there was an election. That wasn't an unrealistic fear. That again, is something that tended to constrain the scope of action for the government. One of the interesting things, though, about pirate radio and for that matter, commercial radio in general, opposing the BBC going back into the 30s, is that it did raise the question of how it is that you actually measure audience size and audience response. And I think one of the interesting side stories to this is that the history of attempts to try to gauge the impact of a medium goes back to that issue. You know, how do you tell how big the audience is for unlicensed radio? And it was really that was the commercial unlicensed part of broadcasting that gave rise to a whole discipline of the social science of listening, figuring out how many listeners there are, how they listen, when they listen, and so forth.
Have any of the former pirate DJs contacted you about this book?
Not yet. It's only been out for a few weeks. We did get a letter from Radio Caroline, which essentially complained that it didn't give enough prominence to Radio Caroline, especially in the 1970s, because Caroline, of course, carried on, and it's still around in the form of an internet broadcaster today. You know, that's true enough. My main focus is on the 60s, and I think it's more the case that Caroline revived than it actually carried on without a break. But that's been the only, as it were, written response that I've had from the veterans, other than the people who I'd been in contact with before, who've sometimes written in to just say, to acknowledge that it's that it's appeared, and to, you know, give their own memories of how it correlates with their experiences of being on the ships.
On your TV, because in case you did not know, we're being brought to you on, brought to you on, brought to you by RADI.
And I was speaking there with Adrian Johns, author of Death of a Pirate.
Thank you.
Well, certainly a pirate radio classic, Soul Coaxing by Raymond Lafiev. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, what can we expect over the next 7 days propagation-wise? Here's our own Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week from December 14th to December 20th, 2013. On December 14th, a 10.7 centimeter flux of 168 down to 165. December 15th, December 16th, 168. December 17th through December 20th, 170. The A index is steady all week long at 5. KP index steady at 2 all week long. 9 new sunspots appear this week. On the west, they are 19, 17, 18, 20, 21, and 23. On the east, we see 19, 12, 16, 19, and 22. NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory is monitoring a large coronal hole in the sun's northern hemisphere. A broad stream of solar wind flowing from this particular coronal hole should reach Earth on December 15th or 17th. For more, see our webpage at www.pcjmedia.com/rprop. Back to you, Keith.
All right, thanks a lot, Dan. And guess what? Well, we're now out of time. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again and catch past editions by visiting our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus. That's all one word. All right, so pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. And don't write all one word after Media Network Plus. I say that because somebody actually did. It's a long story. Anyway, that's all we have time for. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. We hope you enjoy the show. 73 and 88 to the ladies.